Hello, everyone, and welcome to All My Best Friends Are Digital, a podcast about video games and the stories they tell, with me, restored to fresh health after emerging from the horror that is the coronavirus COVID-19, Caitlin Bailey. How are you doing, Caitlin?
Hey, I'm doing wonderful. How about you?
I'm doing very well. I'm glad to see that you are restored.
Yes, me too.
Sorry for taking the week off. We very much appreciate all the words of support, but we are back, and we're going to be talking about video games. We're going to be talking about what we've been playing lately. We're going to be talking about Flashback, the quest for identity, in our retro segment, Gaming Opinions on Old School Funware, a.k.a. Goof. We are then going to be talking about our feature game, which once again is Clair Obscur Expedition 33. There was too much to talk about last time, and so we will be rounding it out today. And in point of fact, we are going to be having more spoiler-free discussions, and so our spoiler-filled, plot-related discussion will be in another bonus episode upcoming in All My Best Friends Are Digital. Wait for it. And then we're going to round things out with some shameless hyping of upcoming titles, what we call Shout. So, Caitlin, what have you been playing lately?
Okay, so given that we had a week off, I've been playing so many games. Beat Final Fantasy IV. I'm very close to being finished with Metaphor ReFantazio. I played some more Blueprints, because why not? But the game I'm going to talk about today is called Do No Harm. Do No Harm is a Lovecraftian doctor simulator. It reminded... I know.
Okay, I'm sure you're going to cover this, but I have to know right away.
Yes.
Are you a monstrous doctor? Are you a doctor who works on monstrous things? Or are you just a doctor who works on people that have been assaulted by monstrous things?
You're a doctor who's working on people, some of which may have encountered eldritch monsters slash are being transformed.
Okay. Sorry for preempting. I just had to... You can't just toss a statement like Lovecraftian doctor at my feet and not expect me to demand a disambiguation. Please go on.
Totally understood. So I picked it up for two reasons. One is that it reminded me a lot of a similar game that I played that I mentioned in passing before on the podcast called Strange Horticulture. And also because some people had made comparisons to Papers, Please. I think that the Papers, Please comparisons perhaps set me up for failure in some ways, because Papers, Please hit me very hard emotionally.
Yes, it does that, doesn't it?
Yes, and Do No Harm did not, but that's okay. So anyway, the gist in Do No Harm is that you're a doctor, you accept a role as a doctor on this like remote island community, and the goal is to make it through your 30-day probationary period. And then each day, patients will come into your office and they describe their ailments in varying amounts of detail. And given what they tell you, plus any other symptoms that you're able to discover via your instruments, you have to just give them the correct injections to heal them. If you do a good job, then you'll gain reputation and you get paid money. If you do a bad job, you can lose reputation and sometimes accidentally kill somebody. And then, of course, there's like this kind of Lovecraftian horror twist to it all. Early on in your tenure, this young woman approaches asking for help. And this is, I don't consider this a spoiler because I believe this is at the end of day one or day two. But she comes in and she's like, oh, I have a lot of pain inside. And you're like, oh, okay, well, let me give you something for your tummy. And then after you do it, you watch what may be a hallucination. I don't know. But basically, her whole body splits in two and there's a lot of teeth and stuff involved. It's gross looking. And then she kind of stitches herself back up and leaves, and you're like, oh no, what just happened? And that kind of also introduces a new mechanic into the game, where when you see things that are weird, you need to take a swig of laudanum to make you feel better again.
Okay.
So, yeah, the whole gist is that you just have to like keep your sanity intact by drinking stuff whenever you see something weird. You have to heal up the villagers, and you have to make it through your 30 days. So there's a few things. One is that the early game is exactly the same every time, meaning if you go through once and you do all the tutorials and you start a new game, you have to do all the tutorials again.
Oh my.
I learned this after I lost my first run around 8 to 10 days, and I was like, okay, I don't want to do that. That sounds stupid. And then I realized that what you're actually supposed to do is you can load your game from any previous day.
Oh, I see.
So I could have started using my previous save at day 3 or something like that. But I didn't do that. I just played through the beginning again. It's a little weird because then you get like, if you do this a lot, you end up with a ton of branching saves. And there's not really a good way that I could see to label any of these saves.
Sounds awkward.
So it's a little bit of a logistical nightmare there if you're actually trying to keep track of anything. But that's okay. And it's also, despite the tutorials, I found it fairly difficult to get the hang of how to do everything. I definitely killed a few people by accident just because I didn't fully understand all of the mechanics.
That's just a professional hazard. As somebody who used to be a medical ethicist, the technical term for that is pulling a whoopsie.
Well, I pulled a number of whoopsies in my day as a doctor.
Happens to the best of us.
Overall, I enjoyed my time there. I think I am done with it. I played around 8 to 10 hours. I got a number of bad endings by where bad means it ended before it was supposed to end. And I got 2 regular endings, which I just did one after the other because there was one option or one thing I could pick at the very end of the game of Do No Harm that I decided to just, you know, try it and then reload and try the other way. But yeah, it was enjoyable. Definitely didn't live up to the Papers, Please comparison. I should have known that it wouldn't going in, but it is what it is.
Papers, Please really is very good at making you feel very strongly, usually unpleasantly,
yes,
in the sense of forcing you on the horns of unpleasant dilemmas all the time. I couldn't help but notice that on the Steam page of Do No Harm, it does talk about being forced to engage in moral choices. So whether that's explicitly in its marketing trying to situate it in comparison to Papers, Please, that's definitely aiming at some of the tension in Papers, Please. What's the scope or tenor of some of the alleged moral choices you're forced to make in Do No Harm?
I guess it's okay. So, I mean, there was one person who I grew increasingly suspicious of through the course of the game and eventually learned that they were likely a person who had been showing up in the newspapers as being a murderer, and I accidentally on purpose murdered him. But then Do No Harm completely undercut me by having the person he was targeting die anyway, and I was like, excuse me? Like, I think that was a bug. To be fair, I think it was a bug, because I did look around a little bit, and some people said that, you know, it happened, and other people said it didn't, so whatever. But for the most part, most of the moral issues seemed pretty cut and dry, at least to me. Like, the gravedigger at one point's like, hey, I want you to murder some of these people, because I need people to bury, and I'll pay you. And if you don't do it, I'll kill you and everyone you love. And it's like, okay, well, no, I'm not gonna just kill people. Like, no, that seems pretty clear to me.
Well, if you're gonna sweet talk me that much, maybe.
And then, of course, you know, there's the sketchy priest that is definitely up to no good, who's like, hey, you know, people confess things to me, and they tell me how they're feeling, and they might not tell you how they're feeling, but I want you to give them these meds. And somebody else saying, hey, anytime you see a lady, just inject her with this mysterious purple liquid I gave you. Like, all of these feel very clear. Like, no, this is wrong, objectively. So I didn't feel too much moral dilemma going through it.
This admittedly scant characterization of some of the scenarios definitely emphasizes how unsophisticated it sounds compared to Papers, Please.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely is not. It's not the same. And I think that any comparisons just do no harm a disservice, because it just it prepares you for something that it's not.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. It sounds like you were able to get something out of it, even though it doesn't rise to the same heights as, you know, one of the all-time indie game greats.
Yeah, and I mean, on the bright side, I didn't spend the entire time feeling like a pit of dread in my stomach. So,
sure,
you know, in that way, it was better in some aspects.
It is surprising how a fantastical horror setting can feel like it has less stakes than the grinding force of bureaucracy in a grim authoritarian hellscape.
Yep. Yep, absolutely.
So what's the next Lovecraftian professional game? So you've been a florist in a Lovecraftian world. You've been a doctor in a Lovecraftian world. I guess Lovecraftian dog walker, is that next?
Yeah, maybe. I would play that.
Are there any Lovecraftian cat games? That's the real issue, I suspect.
Okay, well, there is a cat in Strange Horticulture, but I don't think it counts. It's not really a cat game. It's just a cat that's in a game.
Well, clearly there's a lacuna then. We need to get ourselves a Lovecraftian cat game.
Yes, absolutely. What have you been up to lately, Merc?
I have been playing Void War. Void War. There's a lot to say, and at the same time, there's very little to say. Let me start off where things matter, Caitlin. Have you played FTL?
Yes.
Okay. So FTL came out in 2012, and it is a roguelite starship game where you're going from point to point on a map, having various combat encounters. You have crew, you have systems, and one of the things that I really like about starship games, and this is true parenthetically for both tabletop games as well as digital games, is that a good starship game can make you feel like you're managing a complex beast with systems in it, right? It's not just that you have this unit that you're pushing around on a map. I don't mind games like that as well. But you care about the innards. You care about whether there's enough power going to the shields or the weapons or the life support or various other systems. And you can upgrade these systems individually. And you care about whether these stations are crewed or not. And you care about damage to particular subsystems. And you care about trying to target other subsystems of enemy things. You may think that I am avoiding talking about Void War by first talking about FTL. I am not. I am in point of fact talking about Void War. Why will become clear later. And there's really an endless amount of variety. Like, a lot of roguelites really thrive in variety, and there's just a whole lot of different ship types and crew types and other upgrades you can get, and you're constantly under the gun for more resources because you'd really love to get to be able to equip that new blaster you found, but to that, you need more power to the weapon systems, as well as a beefier reactor to do that. And now suddenly your warp system is on fire and that's a whole deal. Anyway, why am I not actually delaying talking about Void War? Because Void War is one of the most shameless ripoffs I have ever seen in my history of playing video games.
Oh no.
The extent to which it is FTL with the serial numbers filed off and replaced with a sort of Warhammer 40k grimdark slather of paint on top is monstrous. It is so huge. So let me just give you an example. And I think this will articulate one of the things that I really like about FTL and the extent to which Void War is FTL.
Okay.
So in addition to systems, there are subsystems. Subsystems are different in that they are automatically powered. So if you upgrade them, you don't also need to upgrade your reactor. They work automatically on their own power system, / they don't really need power of their own. One of them is the doors. You can open and close doors remotely. This can be particularly useful for, say, venting oxygen out of a particular section, which you might want to do, either because that section is on fire, and fire cannot survive very long in a low oxygen environment, or because you have enemy boarders, and you would very much like for them to be asphyxiated. As you level up your door section, the doors get beefier in response to the aforementioned intruders trying to blast through a door, and or the likelihood of fire going across one room to another when there's a door in between them. And if the door section is crude, then that counts as though the entire door section is one level stronger than it is based on its own level. So if you get spare crew, you can stick somebody on the door section. And you may say, Mark, why are you going into so much detail about all these doors? It works exactly the same way in Void War. Precisely, exactly, there is no difference between how this minor subsystem works in FTL when compared to Void War. And this is not the exception. This is the rule. There are very, very vanishingly small differences between FTL and Void War. And for what it's worth, for the most part, in those two or three little differences, I prefer the way Void War does them. For example, one of the things you have to do in FTL, because I loaded up FTL after playing the demo of Void War for a few hours, to be like, yeah, FTL is really great. I should go back to FTL. I played FTL for like 80 hours, according to Steam. And so going back to it was very comfortable in a lot of ways. There's a certain amount of borderline tedious micromanagement that goes on that's not satisfying. It is very satisfying to be like, okay, well, my shield system is on fire, but at the same time, I need to worry about all these other things. That part's, you know, part of a combat encounter, it's tense. But after a fight is over, you go through, you repair all the subsystems, you send all your damaged crew members to the med bay, wait for them to heal up, send them back to their original stations, and then you warp out. It's just sort of bookkeeping after every combat encounter. It's a little tedious. To its credit, Void War is like, well, what if you didn't have a med bay? What if you just healed a certain percentage of the crew's health every time you jump? And like, that's definitely faster. It's more satisfying. It leads to a sense of this being another currency, so I can't bring my crew members to the brink of death and it being borderline trivial. Mm-hmm. And also, parenthetically, this is also the way it sometimes works in FTL, because there's a variant subsystem that you could acquire that has your medbay work exactly the same way, so it's basically FTL anyway.
Oh, no.
Here I am playing Void War, and it's like, this is really fun. I'm really enjoying this, because this is a ripoff of a game I really enjoy. It is super well done. The map system in Void War, which probably the more significant difference, is a much more traditional point-to-point map system. Whereas in the FTL map system, it's this weird sort of pointillistic star system where, yeah, you can warp a certain distance geographically, so two nodes might or may not be connected based on how far away they are. They're not really on a grid or a hex pattern or anything. However, the individual sector pattern of Void War is exactly the same as the overall strategic map of FTL, where you can always go to, you can maximally choose from one of two points. Anyway, I could go on and on about the ways in which Void War is a ripoff of FTL, and it left me with a deep sense of discomfort after having played it. Like I said, I played the entire demo. I also got the sense that normal difficulty Void War was a little bit easier than normal difficulty FTL, because FTL is a little punishing and a little bit short on resources for you to upgrade things. And in Void War, as I say, the theme is entirely different. If you really like grimdark Warhammer 40k nonsense about chaos demons and weird space cults and stuff like that, maybe the theming is more to your liking. FTL has a vaguely humorous kind of pan sci-fi attitude towards it, slightly more Star Trek than anything else, but not exactly that vibe. So here I am, and I'm like, look, in creative works, there is a huge open question about what is the difference between an homage versus a pastiche versus a straight ripoff, right? I cannot help but feel that Void War definitely, insofar as there's a line, hazy though it may be, in terms of principle, definitely waltzes over the line into straight ripoff. I'm not saying it should be pulled from the Steam marketplace. I'm not saying there should be a basis for legal action. Those are technocratic, specific questions of policy. But from the perspective of a consumer, it ooked me out.
I enjoyed it.
I finished the entire demo. Really liked it. But then again, that's because FTL is a really good game. And mechanically, I thought that the differences were mostly for the good. Thematically, I thought it was a huge step back. I do not find the works of Games Workshop very interesting. I don't like Space Marines. I don't like the Chaos stuff. I just find it a little tedious, frankly. And so that aspect definitely didn't appeal. And the fact that I already own FTL, and I was shocked at how cheap it is on the Steam store. If you don't have FTL, dear listener, you should really give FTL a try. It is an amazing game, and it is well worth the cost of admission. Void War, on the other hand, makes me deeply uncomfortable as a consumer.
Yeah, that's... I mean, okay, so I was just looking at the Steam page. I'm surprised, because, like, on one hand, it's like, sure, given enough resources, anybody could just take any game out there, copy it 95%, and then make it 5% better, you know, by finding, like, oh, well, this part didn't feel that good, so I'm just not going to do that. Like, it's unfortunate how close the two are.
But here's the thing, and here's just sort of a coda to this discussion. I think grounds for future contemplation. I don't think we're going to come anything remotely resembling a conclusion on this.
Yeah.
Would I feel differently if FTL were more like, say, a fighting game, a farming game, a MOBA game, any one of those genres with extraordinarily well-defined conventions, mm-hmm. where it really takes an expert, practiced eye to tell the difference? Like, I completely understand why someone would look at the latest King of Fighters game and the latest Fatal Fury game and say, well, clearly these are the same games, right? It's like, no. They're super different. Let me tell you how they're so completely different, and then ultimately accept the fact that to most consumers, it would amount to the same thing. And, like, insert whatever long-running, well-established genre here. I'm not sure. Like, maybe this is just a knee-jerk reaction because there's not a whole lot of games like FTL out mm-hmm. there in the same way that there are a lot of fighting games. Then again, I mean, the visuals alone, for one thing. Like, they really didn't spend much time even making it look visually distinct. It's really it's really just a carbon copy. So maybe that's less of a defense of Void War and more of a condemnation of how a lot of genres have become ossified and are just iterating far too parsimonious a faction. I don't know. It's a complicated question. And yeah. As I say, I don't know that there should be any sort of broad-based policy or general principle involved. Yeah. But again, as a consumer and as somebody who likes to think about video games seriously, or at least tries to, Void War made me uncomfortable, and I think it crosses a line.
Yeah, I mean, so the closest comparison I can think of at the moment is when I played Stardew Valley for the first time as somebody who played Harvest Moon so much.
Exactly.
Like, when I was growing up. But at the same time, like, I mean, Stardew Valley still clearly had its own take on it. Like, yes, a lot of the gameplay was very similar, but it expanded on things. Like, it did enough that it felt like it was an homage, not a ripoff. So, yeah, I'm sure there's a level of subjectivity there, too.
It's like, I don't play farming games. And when you tell me about the new farming game you're playing, and I ask you, how is this different from the other ones?
Yeah.
Sometimes what you say makes sense to me, and sometimes what you say doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
As somebody who played the crap out of FTL, I can tell you the ways in which I think Void War is different. But here we are.
Yeah.
So that's Void War by Tundra, released this year. There's a demo you can go see. If you haven't played FTL, I recommend FTL. We now move on to our gaming opinions on old school funware, what we call goof. We're going to be talking about Flashback, The Quest for Identity. This was published by Delphine in 1992. There's a whole bunch of different versions, but the creator maintains that the definitive version is on the Sega Mega Drive /Genesis, and so that is the version we played. There's one for the Amiga, there was one for MS-DOS, there was one for the Super Nintendo, which was, oh my gosh, terrible. There's one for the Sega CD, which apparently, unsurprisingly, has a lot of very laborious load times. So, Caitlin, why don't you tell us what's going on in Flashback, The Quest for Identity?
So, okay. I started up Flashback, and within the first 3 minutes, I was like, oh, I didn't realize that Mark tricked me into playing Prince of Persia again. I just find the controls to be so completely unintuitive. Okay, so first, I did try just to play it, and I realized, like, okay, my memory of Prince of Persia is not going to get me very far. So I looked up the manual to figure out what all the buttons were, because I could figure out, like, the running jump, but I couldn't figure out how to do, like, a standing jump forward, and I couldn't figure out how to climb down. I just have to say the number of times I would accidentally pull out my gun, put it away, pull out my gun, put it away. It's like, stop hitting that button, Caitlin. Just stop hitting it. I did not get very far. I tried. So first I was playing on my RG35XX, and I was having a hard time doing the running jumps, like timing them. I was like, okay, maybe. Apparently I forgot that this was also a problem for me with Prince of Persia. But I was like, okay, well, maybe if I just play on the Sega itself, it'll feel a little bit better. So I found our copy, I dug it out, and I went to go play it, and then I realized, like, no, I'm just bad at this. So I sadly don't have very much to say about Flashback, because I could not get past the first level. I did make it to the first healing point, and I was like, oh my god, you can heal, that's wonderful, this is so great. And then I fell off a cliff. Or an enemy shot me and I fell. I don't remember. I fell off a cliff and I had to start over. And I was like, you know what? No. This is a save state only game for me.
Yeah, save states are your friend. No doubt about it. So I resent the implication that this was an opportunity for me to trick you into playing a Prince of Persia type game again.
It was a joke.
I would have phrased it as, thank you, Mark, for giving me the opportunity to once again experience this high quality genre, even if Flashback isn't a good instantiation of it, because I agree with you, the controls are questionable at best.
Okay.
I too had to go to the manual, and then I had to go back to the manual after playing for a while, and then I had to go look up a guide on GameFAQs, because the manual doesn't even fully explain all your movement options. And I'm not even talking about complicated movement options. I'm talking about, like, pretty basic ones.
Yeah.
That you could just kind of, in like, when I go back to Prince of Persia, when I go back to Blackthorn, when I go back to other variations on the theme, this kind of cinematic platformer business, I'm usually able to pick up how to run and jump and grab on ledges and lower myself and walk slowly versus running and all those kinds of things very simply. Flashback is, I think, at times borderline obtuse, if not outright obtuse. One example in particular that I find bizarre is the idea that in order to do a standard sprinting jump, which is bread and butter, a very common thing you need to do in these kinds of things, you need to let go of the directional buttons while running and then understand and take the leap of faith and remember that holding down the button will let you keep running. And then you press up, not pressing any direction. Look, if I'm going to be running in a direction, I'm going to press that direction.
Yeah.
That is my deep understanding of how things work, all right? Mario taught me that, and he swore to me, looked me right in the eyes, and he said, Mark, granted he did it in a kind of racist Italian stereotype, but he said, Mark, this is the way running works in video games. And I said, thank you, Mario. I'm sure this will serve me well for the rest of my life. And then Flashback smacked me upside the head. On top of this, there's a very basic thing that you need to do in a lot of games of this ilk, which is run and grab a platform.
Mm-hmm.
Jump and grab the lip of a platform that's above you. The way you do this in Flashback is by letting Jesus take the wheel, basically. What you do is you start running and then you just hold off and don't press a thing and then accept the fact that if the game wants you to jump up and grab that lip, your character will do that without any further button inputs from you. If you try to press anything else, you'll ruin it. So don't. Just press the run, hold down the run button, tap the direction, let go of the direction. Don't keep pressing the direction. Let go of the direction. And then accept and wish that no, he's not going to run off the edge of the platform 10 feet ahead and break his neck on the fall. No. He's gonna jump up and grab. And sure enough, he does, but it's a harrowing few seconds in the interim. Where all my instincts, and this is all getting to the point, when you're making a game in a well-defined genre, don't mess with the formula. Why are you messing with the formula? Anyway, I could go on and on about the controls. Suffice to say, we both found them unintuitive.
Yeah. Also, the first time I took out my gun, and there was like that little tiny little robot that has like a little antenna that comes up and then like electrocutes you or something.
Yes.
I'd just be shooting. I had no idea if my bullets were hitting or not. So I'm just like, okay. I mean, I guess I'm just going to wait for the little antenna to come up and then just spam the shoot button and hope something happens. And eventually it would die. But I still am not 100% sure what is necessary in order to hit it with a bullet.
The feedback is not great, visually or auditorially or in any other way. What did you think of the look of Flashback?
It looks very cool. Very slick. All of the I don't know what to call them other than like FMVs, like the full screen like video like animations. I thought those were super cool. So they definitely have the look down if nothing else.
Absolutely. This is I still remember the shock at a Genesis game looking this good.
Yeah.
Because not just the little cutscenes that look pseudo-polygonal but not quite.
Yeah.
I mean, calling the pseudo-polygonal is borderline insulting because it's definitely slicker looking than, say, what Star Fox was pulling off. Star Fox is just like, you're playing with blocks, which is fine.
Yeah.
I'm quite enthusiastic about the sort of aesthetic of Star Fox in a number of ways. But Flashback is, they do this weird set of graphical effects that was pretty unique for its time and has aged very well, all told. The frame rate, not so much. It's a very low frame rate game for the animations. And if you can believe it, the Super Nintendo version is yet lower frame rate. Slow down all over the place.
Okay.
And in-game, my understanding is it was not rotoscoped, but it nonetheless has that kind of fluid animation style of rotoscoping. And I am weak to that kind of presentation.
Yeah.
I am definitely willing to do that. And so that I appreciate. But, oh my goodness, it's slow moving. It's got awkward controls. The levels are kind of sparse and lifeless. It's bizarre because I remember very distinctly being intrigued by the setting. Like, okay, so this is science fiction. The main character has lost their memory, hence the term Flashback, the quest for identity. And I never really got very far either when playing it back in the day. And I thought, oh, okay, well, between save states and walkthroughs, I'll finally be able to see more of what Flashback has to offer. And speaking personally, that was only giving me the opportunity for crushing disappointment, Caitlin.
Oh, no.
Because, first of all, I guess this is a minor spoiler, but whatever. Dude gets his memory back very early on in the game.
Okay.
And the only consequence of him getting his memory back is him, this is more my fault for having read the manual, is him remembering the stuff that's included in the manual. Oh. So there's no real big revelation or intrigue there. I guess this is a victory for Caitlin and her non-manual reading ways. And on top of that, I always just had this hope that the opening jungle level was going to make way to some sort of fabulous future landscape.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're trying to make contact with an old friend of the main character who lives in New Washington, which is a city on the planet where they are. The city is empty and lifeless. It's just like the jungle levels, but instead of green everywhere, it's just gray. And I was so disappointed. I wanted like a little bit of intrigue, a little bit of local color, a little bit of something. Nope.
Yeah. Oh.
Just a little bit more with an industrial cone of paint slathered all over it.
Well, that's too bad. It looked very cool. I saw some of what I think were those city kind of levels when I was just sitting on the home screen after, you know, quitting, rage quitting. And it didn't look quite what I wanted it to look like. And I don't know. It was just a little sad.
Because Prince of Persia, for all its virtues, is just a dungeon. And so the dungeon just looks like dungeons of different colors as you go up the levels. Fine, whatever. But that's the setting that it chose, possibly for that reason.
Yeah.
Another contemporary of Flashback is Another World / Out of This World, which was available for largely the same platforms. A number of people remember that. It's the scientist Lester and his alien friend, and you pick up the zapper and all those kinds of things, which in terms of gameplay is a lot less robust. It plays a lot more like one of those old Laserdisc games. But the landscape it's all very understated. The landscape is a series of unknown vistas, and so the fact that it's barren and sparse for the most part leads to a sense of wonder rather than a sense of, is this it?
Yeah, I remember that from Out of This World. Like, just thinking, like, man, like, that's... There may not be a lot there, but it looks cool. Like, I'm interested in this landscape.
This is probably the most disappointing cinematic platform I've ever played. You know, it's still well-regarded in a lot of contexts. I have to assume the graphics are pulling a major duty in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just slow and stodgy and awkward. The combat's awful, frankly, I think. Because you get stun-locked really easily.
Yes.
And you can get blasted off into another screen. And there's this significant delay when transitioning from screen to screen. But the game is still thinking that you're accepting inputs.
Yeah.
So everything feels awfully very sludgy and unfortunate. And like I say, I was hoping for a little bit more intrigue. But no, it's called Flashback, the Quest for Identity. But that, like, after level one, dude gets his identity back. And so, okay. And now we're just going and doing, like, standard... uninteresting narrative fetch elements. It's like, okay, go do the thing. It's like, okay, I'm a now go do the thing. And it's boring, sparse. And, no, I'm sad. I'm sad, Caitlin. I'm sad.
Oh, no. I'm sorry that you're sad, Mark.
I'm also sad that you think that this is some sort of elaborate trick on my part.
I mean, that was a joke. I knew it wasn't, actually. But. I do have to say I liked Prince of Persia better. I remember once I did learn the controls... feeling like I understood how to do things versus Flashback, where just like you, I had to refer back multiple times because it didn't work in my brain. And I would do something and be like, I swear I just did what the controls said to do. And it was just a very frustrating experience.
I'm not going to say that Flashback should have just used mostly the Prince of Persia control scheme. I mean, it could have. I'm not saying that it should have, but it definitely could have. But there were just a number of decisions it made that were just so bizarre. I guess I'll pick on it one more time. I said I was done, but just one more. If you're trying to lower yourself down off of a platform, most of the time in games like this, in tons of other games, what you do is you face the way the character is going to be facing. You face effectively towards the lip, and then the character you press down or some button or whatever, and
yeah.
Then the character just lowers themselves down. In Flashback, you have to be facing the wrong way and then do the button input. So that your digital avatar will turn around and then do the lowering animation. But if you try to do the input while they're facing the other way, nothing happens. So you turn them the wrong way just to put the input so they will turn around again and then lower the... It's a whole scene.
That's very silly. Also, I was trying to remember, was it Blackthorn where you were able to kind of pull back into the background so you wouldn't get shot?
Yes.
I really felt that Flashback could have used that. Because the number of times to be like, okay, I need to get down onto this platform where there's a monster with a gun, and I somehow need to not get hit by him. And it was not easy. And I'm probably just bad at the game, but, you know.
There's a way to do it, but I'm not interested in going through another specific details about how to navigate the awkward controls of Flashback. Yeah, play Prince of Persia, almost any version. Play Blackthorn, play Another World. There are really, really, really good contemporaries of Flashback that are great. Watch the intro, I guess, just to see what the Genesis was capable of.
Yeah.
But past that, not really worth it, I don't think. So that was Flashback, The Quest for Identity. We're now going to take a brief break for some ads.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
And we're back. Once again, we're going to be talking about Clair Obscur Expedition 33, the darling RPG from Sandfall Interactive. Also from France. This is a very from France episode, because Flashback was a French game.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Cool.
Yeah, from Delphine Software.
Oh, that makes sense when you said the name.
So, in the intervening weeks, we have both finished the game. Normally, I take a while to play through JRPGs of this nature. Caitlin burned through it in record time. Would you say, Caitlin, that this occupied the same degree of obsessive focus that I guess the last time you burned through a long game was Dragon Age?
And I did the same to Avowed, although I think I had a forced break from Avowed because I had a work trip in the middle. All three of those just completely occupied every waking moment that I had, that I wasn't forced to be doing something else like work.
Okay, so Expedition 33 did fall into that category.
It absolutely.
Must finish this. This is what I'm doing. This is what I'm up to. I eat so that I may play Expedition 33.
Yes.
I work so that I pay the bills so that I may continue to play Expedition 33.
Yeah, absolutely.
Speaking personally, I wasn't really in that perspective. I was in that perspective during Act 1. I guess minor spoilers, there are three acts to Expedition 33. And just as a reminder, once again, we're not going to get into spoiler-based story beats. We're going to save that for a bonus episode where we talk in detail about the specific character moments, the specific story beats, the ending, etc., etc. And I have many questions for Caitlin about a variety of those things. I'm very curious to hear what she has to say about them. But at any rate, Act 1, as I said last time, I was vacillating between this could be game of the year and this isn't necessarily always playing to its strengths. Mm-hmm. I felt that tonally it was inconsistent. Act 2, I thought, was a complete waste of time. And Act 3, I thought, did a fair amount of work getting it back to Act 1, but not quite. And so I finished it mostly out of a sense of obligation, mostly out of a curiosity to see whether it was going to get better.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to say that overall, I wasn't as enthusiastic about Expedition 33 as you were, which is hardly to be surprising. It's more of a your kind of game than it is mine anyway.
Sure.
I have some specific questions for you, though, based on the things that you said last time about Expedition 33. One of them is that you commented that partially by virtue of how bad the menus are, and partially based on how, let's say, intricate some of the subsystems were, that you had largely ignored Luminous.
Yeah,
did that change?
So I was equipping them, but I wasn't giving too much thought into how they would all play together. I was mostly like, all right, what do I need to do to get more? Like, I am so bad at remembering vocabulary for a game when I'm done playing it. I already can't remember what the action points are called, if they're called anything special.
Well, you could just look it up in the Codex. The Codex will explain these things for you. Won't it?
Hold on.
Expedition 33 wouldn't go to the bother of introducing a bespoke magic, pseudo-magic system with implications for the appearance, even physiognomy of various characters, and not bother to explain anything about them, would they? Would it? No game would be that cavalier, would it?
No, of course not. Don't be silly.
So there are two. Let's disambiguate something. There are Pictos,
mm-hmm.
which are the things that you can equip.
Yes.
And then there are Luminas, which are like Pictos, except they're not. they're equipped in a different way.
Right.
We don't need to go into the detail. And so you're saying that you're equipping Pictos, but not paying particular close attention to the synergies between them. And what were you doing with Luminous?
Yeah. In general, I wasn't paying too much attention to the synergies between anything, either Pictos or Luminous. Okay. I was, you know, every now and then I would go to the curator character and realize that I had, you know, 60 color of Lumina or whatever it was, and actually apply them all to like my different characters. And then I'd be like, oh, cool, I get to equip a bunch more things that I didn't have before. Definitely, especially moving into Act 3, I stopped being so cavalier about everything. And I was just like, okay, I need to actually stop flying by the seat of my pants and have just a little bit of strategy. So I did spend a lot more time thinking about stuff because I felt like going into Act 3, it was a little weird because I didn't really know where to go. I mean, you know where to go to if you want to end the game. But if you don't want to end the game, there's a lot of different options of varying difficulties. Sometimes the game, like Expedition 33, will be like, hey, this place is dangerous. See the red danger that shows up when you try to go here? Don't go here. And other times I would get somewhere and be like, oh, this is still more difficult than I bargained for. But for the most part, actually trying to strategize and create builds fixed most of that.
I was very curious, particularly in Act 3, actually, thinking, oh my goodness, Caitlin beat the game without paying too much attention to Luminous? How on earth did she do that? Was everyone level a billion? Was she just brute force? Because I'm not saying that I found it particularly difficult. I found it challenging at times.
Yeah.
But I definitely felt that I was only getting through by dint of not min-maxing, but definitely being a little bit conscious of how to spend my Lumina points. Now, the way I was able to do this without losing my mind was that every single character was spec'd out exactly the same way.
Okay.
this is how I was able to save my mental resources, right? Because as we mentioned before, every character has their own sub-mechanisms. And then there's a million different little buffs and specs and little perks that you can give them through this Lumina system. And some of them interact with others, some of them don't, and it's a whole thing. And the only way I could get through was just by giving everyone the same profile. They would end up having slightly different ones around the margins by virtue of the Pictos they had equipped.
Sure.
But that's just three from a list of like a dozen. But the rest were just all the same. Auto shell, powerful shell, auto rush, all the same.
I think that as I got into Act 3, and it seems to me that the vast majority of people that I've spoken to who have played Clairobscura did exactly the same thing. I just went all in on Mael. Mael was the character that I understood the best. And also, she just could do absolutely bananas damage. So, yeah, I just went all in on Mael. And everyone else, Luna sometimes did, like, some pretty good stuff. I had this one ability that would put one stain of each color down, and then another one where if all the stains were different colors, you could use it, and it was relatively cheap, but did tons of damage. So, like, those are my two main damage dealers. And then I had a third character who I won't name, just doing whatever, and it was cool, but...
Okay, so let's talk about the different characters, specifically with respect to the damage system, because, yes, the consensus on the internet is very much that Mael is basically a tiny wayfish nuke.
Yes.
Past Act 1, maybe about halfway through Act 2, Mael, for some reason, and I couldn't even tell you why, fell behind the power curve and never caught up.
Oh, no.
I just... So in, like, parts of Act 1, parts of the beginning of Act 2, I'd be like, oh, I need to do a trillion points of damage with a single attack. Mael, you're on deck. And she'd be like, okay. And, like, get her be in her correct stance and then do the thing. And then it's like, oh, yeah, that's the damage. That's the stuff. But for some reason... This is just generally, like I said, I beat the game.
Yeah.
I spent a non-trivial amount of time thinking about Luminous and how to activate them. I had zero ability to anticipate based on the text of an ability. And even my historical experience with a character about how much damage a given thing was going to do. I could have someone trigger an attack that exploited their elemental weakness. And the description of the ability says extreme damage. And it just being like a tiny pinprick and me being like, why? And then someone else does something that's described as moderate damage,
yeah,
that is not based on elemental weakness, do literally 10 times as much. I'm not exaggerating. It is by that scale. And I could not, from moment to moment, predict. I'd have to see it and how it shook out. And that would just be my reality for a couple of hours.
Yeah.
And then sometimes, a couple hours later, my reality would totally change. I didn't spec them out differently. I didn't change the luminas. I'm using the same attacks. Suddenly, everything is different. And it led me to conclude that I was just living in some sort of weird, bizarre, parallel fantasy world, which I guess is thematically appropriate, but yeah, still confusing. Yeah. Did you have this experience?
I did not, thankfully, because that sounds very confusing.
I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what it was that I was doing, Caitlin. I would look at the numbers. I would stare at the numbers till I was blue in the face. And like, I understood how to pull the various levers and everything. At least I think I did. And it wasn't just unidirectional. It wasn't just I'm doing less damage than I think I should. It's just the other half of the time I'm doing way more than I think I should be able to be doing with different characters. And unfortunately, Mael was always one of the ones that underperformed through the back half, and I just could not figure it out.
Oh, that's so funny to me. Like, I wonder why that happened. I mean, I imagine that some of it could be weapon and stat related, but I'm assuming that if you have a weapon that has a B or an A in a stat, that you are putting stat points into that stat in order to get better damage scaling out of the weapon. So I don't know what would cause that otherwise. That sounds miserable.
Like I say, I just had to kind of ignore what the game was telling me in terms of numbers and text and just go mostly on vibes. The only time it got seriously frustrating was there are some events, some voluntarily, some not, where you're forced to use a single character at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And if those happened to be one of the characters that was underperforming, it was sometimes a little bit of a slog. But then usually, as I say, I could retune my luminas and have a better time of it. Like, for example, I was having a little bit of a struggle for a while until I just said, you know what? I'm just going to set everything on fire, and I'm going to give everyone the lumina that says you heal every time you hit somebody who's on fire. Mm-hmm. That made the game that made things significantly easier, even in some of those weird boss encounters. So I was able to get through, but like I say, it was strangely confusing.
Yeah, I think something else that bugged me a little bit with respect to the luminas was, so like I said, I use my L anytime I could for pretty much everything. But if I was ever doing one of those solo battles with her, I always wanted to switch out a few luminas because I had some that if you're the only person in a fight, you do a lot more damage or whatever. So I'd have to switch them all the time. But then there wasn't any... I'm 99% sure that there's not a way to save a loadout of luminas and switch back to it quickly.
No.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah. I was like suddenly doubting myself as I'm about to say it. But that kind of sucked because it felt like, oh my god, like now that I got Mael all ready for all of her duels, now I have to make her ready for, you know, actual group combat again, and I have to switch everything out. And it could get a little bit tedious at times.
The worst part for me was, again, and I don't mean to harp on the terrible menu system too much, but you'd be there saying, okay, I have an idea for how I'm going to spec out this character. Say I want Luna to have these three other luminas that I've just unlocked over the course of things. Mm-hmm. Okay, she's going to swap out A for B, and then I'm going to equip C and D. Okay, that means she's short 17 points of lumina. Exit out the menu. Go to the curator. Activate the curator menu. Sync the 17 points into her. Exit out. Go back in.
It does feel like you could have just applied it in the menu, right? Like...
Yes.
That would have been really much nicer.
So moving on to some other gameplay elements that I half came to terms with and half didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And just as a general note, I appreciate the fact that Dark Souls was a singular achievement in gaming design, but I would like to encourage the games industry to be willing to not be Dark Souls. Not everything needs to have multi-limbed horror monstrosities and a parry system. I think that we can move on and accept that we can have some variety. So on the dodging and the parrying, by the end of the game, you have four different kinds of defensive maneuvers. And these are kind of like the real-time defensive checks. This is on top of the real-time offensive checks, which sometimes cause your entire attack to miss. I just stopped using those.
Yes.
Thankfully, the jump always maintains a certain level of clarity. The chromatic counter only gets frustrating sometimes, mm-hmm. but this was one of those instances where a short YouTube video helped everything click into place. The last time I had this experience, to this extent was definitely when we were playing Sifu. Mm-hmm. And I watched that video that said the tutorial trained you for failure. It turns out that there is a unique auditory cue with reliable timing before every attack that tells you when you need to dodge or parry. Did you know this?
I learned it far too late. Let's put it that way.
Same here. So the moment you know this, so people are playing the game. My complaint from last week very much stands. Your enemy will do some sort of leap or run to where you are, cock back their fist for what feels like 7 minutes, as though they're threatening you like a high school bully, and then launch into a three-hit combo with weird timing. It never gets intuitive, but if you know to just wait for the sound, sometimes, I mean this sincerely, sometimes I actually found it easier to just close my eyes.
Yeah.
In terms of when to defend, because the visuals were so distracting.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was one character in particular, Golgra. I had to duel her with Mael because I was trying to get a really good weapon for Mael. It was such a frustrating experience because she would like launch into this thing and her arms and her legs and everything is going everywhere. I'm like, oh my God, I don't know what to look at. I don't know when she's going to hit me. Like, that was before I learned about the audio cue. So it was not a good time.
And near the end of the game, I'm not even talking about optional encounters. I'm not even talking about random encounters. Some of the boss encounters, we're talking 7-8-hit strings. Mm-hmm. It was almost comical how tedious a lot of these attack strings were. I'm just sitting there wearing my thumbs out for a single combat string, and I'm expected to be able to dodge and or parry all these things. Now, granted, they're not all one-shots.
Right.
The one-hit kills tend to be a little bit better telegraphed most of the time, unless you're going to one of the optional dangerous locations. But I just thought it was completely unnecessary. It was so bizarre having them wail on you for that. They were just comically long, for one thing.
Well, yeah, and then you have one of those instances where it's your last character alive, they get killed on the first hit of this 8-hit combo, and you have to watch them do the other 7 hits before you get a game over screen. It's like, no!
Look, all told in terms of the gameplay, I think all net-net, I'm positive the real-time elements, broadly speaking. I just don't necessarily know I can condone entirely how they were implemented, and I certainly wish they'd give me that little clue about the auditory inputs at the beginning. Yes. That would have made me much more forgiving towards the absurd, unpredictable animations of the enemies.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Like, I genuinely enjoyed the combat 95% of the time. It always felt really good when I got a really nice parry string going. Honestly, by the end, I was so hyper-focused on parries that I started forgetting that I could just dodge and it would be easier. That was a little bit of a lower point for me. But I genuinely had fun doing the fights. I had fun just destroying people with tiny little Mael. Or not people, but, you know, Nevrons. But it was...
Well, are they people?
I mean, yeah.
Tough to say.
That's a conversation for...
That's a separate conversation. It's a whole thing.
It is a whole thing. I mean, for me, all in all, I think there's a very good chance that Clair Obscur could end up being one of my favorite games of the year. We'll see. There's still time.
Okay, so we'll circle back to that later. I have some more specific questions on that.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got minor gripes as well. Like, I'm a little bit tired of everyone always having a British accent. I couldn't help but notice that the only character I thought who sounded vaguely French is, in point of fact, the same actor who voices the character in both the English and the French versions of the game.
Really?
Yeah, Esquier okay. Is voiced by the same actor in both. And I could tell just based on the emphasis on various syllables. I'm like, oh yeah, that dude either speaks French or knows how French sounds. And it's like, oh no, he just speaks French.
Yeah, okay.
Everyone else had a vague British accent. Fine, whatever. It was localized in England. I can accept that. So this isn't quite my same objection to the way that everyone in Prince of Persia game sounds vaguely British or anyone in Roman game sounds vaguely British. Fine. And Mael sounded pretty good as far as sounding vaguely French, but everyone else sounded pretty English as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
I was almost shocked at how clumsily the plot was presented in Acts 2 and 3, because in very much the same way that Dark Souls has left a large shadow over pretty much all games, the Persona games have left a large shadow over JRPGs in general. Mm-hmm. And there's this almost Persona-esque rhythm that you get into, where you go through a series of combat encounters, a kind of a dungeon-ish type thing, and then you're at camp. And at camp, you can have specific encounters with each of your party members, and they can raise the loyalty level, the friendship level, that you have with various camp members. The salient difference is, there are two reasons, though, why I don't think this works well in Expedition 33 at all. Number one was that the pacing was just really leaden. Because it's not that you would do a little combat thing, and then a little dialogue thing, and then a little other thing, and a little other thing, the way you would do in a Persona game or in Metaphor di Fantasio. In Expedition 33, you would do a huge block of combat, and then a huge sequence of dialogues. Right? They were not spread out. They were delivered to these huge dumps. And I don't... They needed to be spaced out, I think.
I did have that same experience, and I found myself wondering, although I don't know that this would have amounted to anything, but I found myself wondering, like, should I have been camping more between areas? But I don't think so, because I think any time I did go to camp, I would try to talk and no one had anything to say. But then, yeah, I had this one sequence where I'm pretty sure I had three scenes in a row with most characters, and that didn't really make any sense to me, like why it would be so grouped together.
Oh, I didn't have three in a row, but yeah, I had the same experience. I would camp at other times, and they would have nothing new to say. It really seemed like they would only open up new dialogue after major story beats, and then would all unlock at the same time.
Oh, like each character? Yeah.
Yeah, it was just a little bit of a gauntlet. And the other thing is that in these encounters, first of all, they all take place at the same place where we make camp, just this dark cliff. And the establishing writing was so clumsy. It's weird, because we talked about how Expedition 33 can make an entire meal out of Gustav looking away and stammering for half a second. And the viewer is like, yes, and be so there for it, and it's so wonderful and so well done and so understated. And then, I don't know when exactly in Act 2 it was introduced, but it was in Act 2 and in Act 3, during these little vignettes, they just have the major stuff buried in the establishing text or the teardown text. So like it'll be like this very clumsy, like, Nune has X, Y, and Z on her mind, comma, so she goes to talk to whoever who has A, B, and C on their mind. What follows then is a cutscene in engine, which is fine, and then it's like, on their way back to the camp, Nune announced a deep secret that she had to someone, or something like that. It was so clumsy and weird.
I do agree that could get a little bit weird. I don't think I was quite as taken aback as you seem to be by it, but yeah, I agree that like sometimes the introduction, it's like you could have just showed us, right?
Yeah,
like you didn't have to tell us that is what was happening.
It was literally a show don't tell moment.
Yeah,
literally. And for the things that are about what's on a character's mind, again, you Expedition 33 have shown us that you're able to do that really well, because you've done a great job with your cast, and you've done a great job of facial animations and motion cap and everything, and you can pull this off. So why are you dumping this on me in just an establishing line of text? And on a couple of occasions, I'm making a big deal out of it because I was so angry at the time, actual plot moments, significant character development plot moments, once or twice, were just dumped in a line of text that was surrounding a cutscene. Why didn't you put it in the cutscene? So weird. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, so I'm having difficulty remembering really significant stuff, so I'm like dying to know exactly what you're referring to, but we can talk about it in a spoilery discussion later.
Absolutely. Fair enough.
I know I already complained last week about there not being a map, and I'm not going to complain too much more about it, except that it sucks, and I'm still kind of mad that they made that choice. But other than the lack of map, I thought that exploring was still a complete joy. There's so many beautiful vistas in each area, and it's difficult to go through one of the levels in Clair Obscur and not just get blown away by something that you see there. Like, I just, they definitely have a good mind for the aesthetic that they're going for, and they pull it off repeatedly.
They get a little corpse heavy at times.
Sure.
But other than that, I absolutely agree. I think visually it's stunning, both on a micro level in terms of the individual characters and the way they move and talk, and on a macro level in terms of the overall vistas. My only minor gripe about the visual presentation is I feel like I couldn't remember the animation of any character's attacks because it had been reduced to a QuickTime event and all I was doing was looking for the prompt. But that's a very, very minor gripe.
Yeah, that makes sense. I thought that music was wonderful. I've been listening to the soundtrack at work. just because I want to hear more of the music, especially like the main Lumiere song, I just think is absolutely beautiful. And I'm excited to hear more from this composer someday, just because I thought he did an amazing job with this.
I agree. It's great. It's very characteristic. It's very evocative of a mood, both specifically for the game and for a kind of pseudo but not quite Belle Époque Paris kind of vibe. 100%.
And I was thinking, I don't know if I'm ever going to do this because I have so many other games I want to play. But if I do ever do a New Game Plus for Clair Obscur, I definitely want to try playing with the French voices. I didn't even know that they had like the French audio available, and apparently they do. So I would love to play with that just to see what it's like, see if it changes the vibe at all.
I tried it, and they were very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
I was knocked out of the experience by their specific use of idiomatic slang.
Okay.
That is not my idiomatic slang because I speak Quebec French as opposed to hexagonal French.
Yeah.
And consequently, I found it too jarring. And so I had to turn it back to the English voices.
Okay. That's understandable. And I don't want to harp on the voices too much, but I do like, why? Why is British like... British accents are just, that's what you have if you are in a, like an RPG.
Historical or foreign setting, yeah.
And it's like, this is literally a fantasy world. You can do anything you want.
It's true.
But everybody's British, so, you know.
Like have more characters of color, for example.
Yeah.
Game was a little white.
It was pretty freaking white.
So, you said that Expedition 33 was in... so far, it's early yet in the year, let's be frank.
Yeah, absolutely.
But definitely in the running for one of your favorite games of the year. I remember when we talked about Avowed, that at the time I said it was an early contender for Game of the Year. Not that we give out awards or anything,
but
just in terms of the experiences we've had thus far. I'm not saying that you're committed to the same view that you expressed at the time, but has your opinion changed?
I think that the type of game, like combat-wise... being a JRPG, I think Clair Obscur is a little bit more my style game versus like Avowed, where it's fine. It's like, it was enough.
Yeah.
Versus Clair Obscur, where I did genuinely, for the most part, there are absolutely exceptions, but I genuinely enjoyed it 90% of the time. I think that might help me you know, edge a little bit ahead of Avowed, but I mean, I loved both, honestly, for different reasons.
They're very different games.
Absolutely.
The fact that they can nominally be included in even the most broad of genre characterizations, admittedly, RPG without modifier is a pretty huge area of gaming, especially now.
Yeah.
But they're about as different as they can get within the broad RPG label. I really respect Clair Obscur Expedition 33's ambition. I'm going to remember a lot of the things that happened for a long time. I'm going to remember the characters, some of the characters especially, for a long time. But overall, I found Act 2 to be painful. I genuinely did not enjoy it. I enjoyed elements, sure, and there were aspects of the charm. But especially in hindsight, I think that what Expedition 33 was trying to do in many ways was not calibrated to my preferences in a very serious and fundamental way.
Mm-hmm. I'm very excited to talk to you about Act 2 in particular. So just to see your thoughts.
I found a lot of it compelling. I didn't find a lot of it interesting.
Sure.
As opposed to big dilemmas that Avowed presented us with that I found both compelling and interesting.
Yeah.
And for all its visual flair, to a large extent, I feel like the world of Expedition 33 doesn't cohere. Now, to a certain extent, that's deliberate. They made a series of creative choices that I think mean that it didn't have to cohere in a lot of the ways that I wouldn't want it to. But ultimately, for every moment of greatness, for every moment of genius, for every moment of wonder, for every moment of brilliance, for me, I had almost as many moments of disappointment, frustration, confusion in Expedition 33. And while I really think that it rallied considerably near the end in a lot of ways, I honestly feel like I could have stopped after Act 1 and I'd gotten like 90 to 95% of what there was to be had from Expedition 33.
Did you feel that the emotional... Oh, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't know. The tone, I guess. Do you feel like that evened out? Because I do feel like early on, Gestrels immediately followed by Eskie is a lot.
Yes. In point of fact, I would have liked a little bit more levity. There was too much levity in Act 1. There wasn't enough in Act 2.
Okay.
I agree with you. The tempo, the timing of Gestrel Village followed immediately by Midi Eskie is just rough. Very badly done.
Yeah.
And... I would. There were moments, actually, in Act 2 or 3 where I'm like, yeah, I wouldn't mind a little bit more gestural action right now. They could have spread it out a little bit better. So, yes, I did think that the tone was evened out considerably.
Yeah.
Even if the pacing wasn't. All right, so that's Expedition 33. More to follow for our dear Patreon backers. If you wish to support us on Patreon, you can find us on patreon.com/amfad, where we have bonus episodes on many of these more plot-driven RPGs, as well as some other stuff. We would appreciate your support if at all possible, but before we leave you, we are going to now engage in some shameless hyping of upcoming titles. What would you like to shout out for us, Caitlin?
So today, I'm going to shout out Deltarune. It's another game by Toby Fox, who's the creator of Undertale, and it's described as a parallel story to Undertale, and it's set to come out in just a few days on June 4th. So I know that the first... I believe I played part of the first chapter when it first came out as a demo, and then I decided, like, you know what, I'm just going to wait for Deltarune to fully come out. But it's almost here, so I'm very excited. Yeah, I'm definitely going to be playing some Deltarune at some point in the near future.
This was a game that was released in several chapters, right?
And yes.
Then, but is this the final definitive version or just another set of chapters?
Up till now, I believe the previous chapters have all been available as a, quote, demo. So I think that's chapters 1 and 2. Then... chapters 1 through 4 will be available when Deltarune comes out on June 4th. I believe they've also said that future chapters will be released for free. So I don't really know what that means as far as a story, if it's going to be like a complete story in those first few chapters, but I will find out.
Very interesting. Also to be released very, very soon is Elden Ring and Night Rain.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I was made aware of this was in the context of the rollout of the Switch 2. parenthetically, have you pre-ordered your Switch 2, Caitlin?
I have not, no.
Was it the tariffs or just the sheer expense?
I put my name on a list. Like, Nintendo opened up, like, a pre-order interest list before the tariffs happened. And I put my name on that.
Right.
And then I hadn't heard anything ever since then.
Oh.
And I don't know. There's nothing that I was absolutely dying to play on the Switch 2 on release.
What about the same Zelda game for the 7th time, Caitlin?
is there a Zelda game coming out that with the Switch 2?
Yeah, there's this. I think it's either Breath of the Wild or Tears of the Kingdom. It's whatever.
Really?
It's another set of re-releases for the same Zelda games.
Yeah, that's okay. I don't need that.
Well, the only launch title that made any that had any appeal for me was Elden Ring Night Rain, and sure enough, it's going to be available on Steam. So I will be getting that version. Honestly, I was a little disappointed. I never considered getting the thing.
Yeah.
Because it's a fair amount of money and a lot of hardware that I don't have any interest in. I was like, oh, okay, well, that's too bad. But it's going to be available on Steam, so I'll be able to play Elden Ring Night Rain. It's coming out this week.
I'm very surprised that it's for the Switch 2.
You and a lot of very angry PlayStation and Xbox owners. The conspiracy theory is that this is a middle finger to Sony for not re-releasing Bloodborne. I don't know. This is about money.
Yeah.
Somebody made some money somewhere. I don't know. I don't think this is about a petty schoolyard beef.
I would like to believe that it's not a petty schoolyard beef. If it is, then, you know, I stand corrected.
Who's to say? Anyway,
So that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. For All My Best Friends Are Digital, we appreciate you spending the time. We liked having you with us. And we hope to see you again soon. Just as a note, we are now on YouTube as well. We've only done it for this episode and the past episode. But if you like to consume your podcasts on YouTube and you'd like to see some of our gameplay footage of us being occasionally very inept at playing video games, you can find All My Best Friends Are Digital on YouTube. We'd love to have you there as well. Take care, everyone. See you soon.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in touch, you can reach us at allmybestfriendsaredigital@gmail.com. Hope to see you again soon.